gas prices are rising across Europe as Russia further slashes its gas supply to the continent amid continued tensions over the war in Ukraine. Railways in the UK come to a standstill as workers strike over pay, job security, and working conditions. And the U.S. Justice Department is reportedly examining former President Trump's role in last year's Capitol attack as part of the election-related criminal probe. Thanks for joining us. Gas prices are soaring across Europe as Moscow slashes gas supply through the single biggest pipeline to Germany. Gas prices have increased by 9%, inching closer to an earlier all-time high. The Nord Stream 1 pipeline that brings Russian gas to Europe via Germany is now operating at less than a fifth of its normal capacity. Russia previously cut flows through the pipeline to 40% in June, citing maintenance work. The European Union says that Moscow is using energy as a weapon against European countries. The Kremlin, however, says that the disruption in gas supply is due to the bloc's sanctions against Russia. The Russian official said the EU sanctions have made his country impossible to carry out maintenance work on the pipeline. He also said that Moscow cannot ensure gas supply if the EU hinders the process itself. Europe has heavily relied on Russian gas and imported 40% of its natural gas from Russia until last year. On Tuesday, EU energy ministers approved an emergency plan to cut gas consumption by 15% in the coming winter. The International Energy Agency has warned Europe is facing a red alert over its gas consumption and is at risk of winter energy rationing.
Up to a quarter of the EU's electricity demand is generated using gas. In some of the bloc's member states, it is higher. As less of it arrives from Russia, EU nations have agreed to reduce gas consumption by 15% until spring.
I think at the end, everybody understands that this sacrifice is necessary. We have to, and we will share the pain.
Many in the European Parliament say the pain is not being shared equally.
Only working class people are dying. But the EU has done nothing to stop us. And so many people in here are glad the war has taken place.
Within NATO, there is opposition to Finland and Sweden joining the military alliance. Within the EU, there is opposition to the bloc's foreign policy towards Russia. There are also tensions between the EU and the UK.
At present, it appears diplomacy in the West simply isn't working. Trust between allies is at an all-time low. How this will all play out is anybody's guess.
It has been suggested that Russia wants Western allies to fall out.
Now is not the time for finger-pointing. We understand that they want to destroy, they want to divide, they want to split this solidarity and unity.
Critics say the West is responsible for the war in Ukraine because Russia's security concerns were ignored and even preyed upon. Experts suggest the conflict has highlighted the EU's weaknesses and has exposed the lack of energy infrastructure investment within the bloc.
That is why investing in grids, in interconnectors, in something as boring as pipelines, that matters.
Ordinary people in the EU are asking, how did we get to this point? There is a cost of living crisis and all sorts of security concerns. Analysts warn there will be political ramifications. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In the UK, rail workers have launched a fresh strike over pay, job security and working conditions. The 24-hour walkout by more than 40,000 workers is expected to close half of the country's rail network and will cause disruption to millions of people. Passengers are being advised to travel across the country only if necessary. The recent talks between the workers' unions and the employers made no breakthrough. The unions are not satisfied with the pay rise offer, arguing that it does not cover the rising inflation costs. A similar strike in June severely disrupted rail services for 3 days. The U.S. Justice Department is reportedly examining former President Trump's role in last year's Capitol attack as part of the election-related criminal probe. U.S. media are citing sources as saying that federal prosecutors are questioning former White House officials about Trump's involvement in the deadly riots at the Capitol. A congressional committee has been holding its hearings into the incident. The committee says Trump should be held accountable for a dereliction of presidential duty. But the panel of senators does not have the power to bring criminal charges against Trump. Therefore, any investigation by the Justice Department into the former president's personal role is very significant. Trump, however, has denied the accusations, calling them total fiction. Colin Campbell is a correspondent who joins us to tell us more about this. We know the investigations have taken place and some of Trump's inner circle at this point, the most high profile one being Steve Bannon, to have been accused of his role in a sense. But when it comes to Trump, what are we looking at here? What have these investigations at this point shown?
Well, right now, they're still looking at more evidence as to what happened that day and how the president was connected to the January 6th insurrection. I know that sounds like almost unbelievable because there is already so much evidence that has been collected and so much that has been talked about. But the Department of Justice is still looking at whether the president was more deeply involved in trying to overturn the election. Now, there is audio of him speaking to the Secretary of State of Georgia, the Georgia Secretary of State, asking for more votes. We do know that he delayed in trying to tell protesters and rioters to go back home on January 6th. But of course, there could be other communications, other text messages, other types of discussions that the president could have had with members of his cabinet. We know that Mark Short, the former aide for the former vice president at the time, talked about how things could have been much worse had the mob gotten closer to the former vice president. And the former president really didn't do much to try to dissuade protesters from trying to reach the former vice president. In fact, saying that maybe they had the right idea. I'm paraphrasing there, but it almost was like he was endorsing the vitriol that the protesters were expressing about the former vice president at the time. So again, this is a former president. Usually, whatever issues the former presidents have, the next administration is willing to overlook them. I guess it's part of the culture that has become part of the presidency or in America for the past several decades and generations. When we look at what happened with Watergate and Nixon and how he received a pardon by the succeeding president and how things were seemingly pushed under the rug. Well, in this case, I don't think that is going to be as cut and dry. Although the current president, Biden, has not really gone after the former president every day, you hear how the current president's tone is not very approving of the former president. We know that the Department of Justice, the Attorney General, says that no one is above the law and hasn't testified the investigation. So when we're looking at the former president here, a lot of more evidence would need to be amassed before the Department of Justice Attorney General has the confidence to say, okay, we're definitely going to press charges, because this would be unprecedented.
Thank you very much for that. Colin Campbell there from Washington, D.C. Thank you.
You got it.
U.S.-China tensions are heating up again over a potential visit by the U.S. House Speaker to Taiwan. Beijing has issued a fresh warning, saying that it would take countermeasures if Nancy Pelosi lands on the island.
We have repeatedly stated our solemn position that we are firmly opposed to Speaker Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. If the U.S. pushes ahead and challenges China's bottom line, it will inevitably face firm countermeasures. The U.S. side will bear all the consequences arising therefrom.
This is the latest in a series of warnings since reports emerged that Pelosi could pay a visit to Taipei during her regional tour in August. Last week, the Financial Times reported that China had alarmed the U.S. privately that the move could possibly provoke a military response. Beijing stressed that such a visit would send a wrong signal to separatist forces in Taiwan. If she arrived in Taiwan, it would be the first trip by a sitting U.S. House Speaker in over two decades. The plan is likely to surface during a phone call between the Chinese President Xi Jinping and his U.S. counterpart Joe Biden this week. Biden is opposed to Washington's growing military and diplomatic ties with Taiwan, in which China considers as part of its territory. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says that his country has successfully challenged the West's long-standing attempts to promote the idea of the separation of religion from state. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the Islamic Republic has targeted the focal point of the Western civilization, which he noted is the separation of religion from state. The leader said Western powers, supported by the Zionist regime and its capitalists, are angry at Iran's advancement. He underlined that the Islamic Republic has not only made their anti-Tehran plots futile, but has proven that there is no contradiction between religion and development. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks while addressing a group of Friday prayers leaders. Iran's foreign minister says economic diplomacy and promoting relations with neighboring and Muslim states are among the foreign policy priorities of his country. Hossein Amir Abdollahian was virtually addressing the 20th ministerial summit of the D8 Organization for Economic Cooperation, also known as Developing 8, in the Bangladeshi capital of Dhaka. Amir Abdollahian stressed that regional cooperation is key to peace, stability, and development. He also noted that strengthening multilateral mechanisms such as D8 is of great importance for Tehran. The top diplomat reiterated Tehran's support for collective efforts of developing countries toward an efficient international economic system. Amir Abdollahian also said that Iran is ready to help the international community cope with the ongoing energy crisis and food insecurity. Uzbekistan has hosted an international conference on Afghanistan in the capital, Tashkent. More than 20 countries and international organizations, including the U.S., Afghanistan, and Iran, were in attendance. Afghanistan's security and economic development topped the agenda of the meeting. Our Kabul correspondent, Abdullah Amirzadeh, joins us now to tell us more about the summit. Well, Abdullah, what do you have for us regarding the summit?
Hello, yes, actually, as you know, there was a meeting held in Tashkent, Uzbekistan. It started yesterday with one-day delay. It was supposed to start on Monday, but it started yesterday on Tuesday. The title of this meeting was Security and Economic Development. More than 20 countries and international bodies were participating to this international meeting. The main goal of the event was to develop a set of measures and proposals for the approaches of the world community to promote stability, security, and post-conflict reconstruction in Afghanistan. Countries that were participating in this meeting includes Afghanistan, the United States, Pakistan, Islamic Republic of Iran, Russia, and some other countries and organizations. From Afghanistan, Amir Khan Muttaqi, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and his accompanying delegation traveled to Uzbekistan and participated in this meeting about Afghanistan's situation. In his speech, Amir Khan Muttaqi at this meeting talked about issues such as security, economy, governance, and the importance of regional cooperation to ensure security in Afghanistan and in the region. He also added that Afghanistan's economy is affected by the 20-year war, and the recent sanctions imposed by the United States have also had an effect on its deterioration, and the closure of Afghan assets by the United States of America has disturbed the banking system in Afghanistan. Muttaqi once again asked the United States of America to release the assets of Afghanistan and remove the sanctions. From Islamic Republic of Iran, another participant, Hassan Kazemi Kumi, said that the way out of the crisis starts only from within Afghanistan. He also added, there is readiness in the international community and the neighbors to start an active interaction with the authorities and people of this country in order to get out of the crisis. From Russia, Zamir Kabulov, the special representative of the President of Russia for Afghan Affairs, criticized the blocking of $7 billion of Afghan capital by the United States of America, and also mentioned that the United States committed theft by doing so. Meanwhile, Thomas West, the U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan Affairs, has announced that his country, the United States, is ready to negotiate with the Taliban officials about the fate of the frozen money. Rino Amiri, another envoy from the United States, special representative for women's and girls' rights, also met. Security, economic stability, and peace are not possible without supporting women's rights and without ending aggression against all ethnic and religious communities and strengthening inclusive political process. From Pakistan, Muhammad Sadiq, also the counterpart part of Mr. Kazemi Kumi, special representative of Pakistan for Afghanistan affairs, mentioned that reopening of girls' secondary schools will not only signal the international community, but will also ensure Afghanistan's long-term societal progress. From Europe, Thomas Nicholson, on the other hand, the European Union's special representative for Afghanistan, said that the European delegation in Tashkent did not call the Taliban government of Afghanistan in response to the words of one of the figures close to the Taliban, that all the representatives present at the Tashkent meeting referred to the Taliban as the government of Afghanistan.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Unfortunately, we're just running out of time there, but we do appreciate that information coming out of that meeting, obviously a very important one for Afghanistan, at least in terms of its recognition. We'll have to see how that goes. Abdullah Amirzadeh, correspondent there, talking to us from Kabul. And that is for World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The EU, NATO, and the West are not only losing the global battle of narratives, they have never won it in the first place, says Ramzi Baroud, journalist, in an article published under the heading the war diplomat, how Borrell and the West lost the global battle of narratives. Stay tuned for the details of this article. In a blog entry reflecting on the G20 foreign ministers' meeting in Bali, Indonesia, on July 7th to 8th, the High Representative of the European Union, Joseph Borrell, seems to have accepted the painful truth that the West is losing what he termed the global battle of narratives. Borrell admitted, "The global battle of narratives is in full swing, and for now, we are not winning." Borrell's piece is a testimony to the very erroneous logic that led to the so-called battle of narratives being lost in the first place. Borrell starts by reassuring his readers that despite the fact that many countries in the global south refuse to join the West sanctions on Russia, everybody agrees, though, in abstract terms, on the need for multilateralism and defending principles such as territorial sovereignty. The immediate impression that such a statement gives is the West is the global vanguard of multilateralism and territorial sovereignty. The opposite is true. The U.S. Western military interventions in Iraq, Bosnia, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, and many other regions around the world have largely taken place without international consent and without any regard for the sovereignty of nations. In the case of the NATO war on Libya, a massively destructive military campaign was initiated based on the intentional misinterpretation of United Nations Security Council Resolution 1973, which called for the use of all means necessary to protect civilians. Borrell, like other Western diplomats, conveniently omits the West's repeated and ongoing interventions in the affairs of other nations, while painting the Russian-Ukraine crisis as the starkest example of blatant violations of international law. Would Borrell employ such a strong language to depict the numerous ongoing war crimes in parts of the world involving European countries or their allies? For example, France's despicable war record in Mali, or even more obvious, the 75-year-old Israeli regime occupation of Palestine? When addressing food and energy security, Borrell lamented that many in the G20 have bought into the propaganda and lies regarding the actual cause of the food crisis. Again, Borrell was selective with his logic. While naturally, a war between the two countries that contribute a large share of the world's basic food supplies will detrimentally impact food security, Borrell made no mention that the thousands of sanctions imposed by the West on Moscow have disrupted the supply chain of many critical products, raw material, and basic food items. When the West imposed those sanctions, it only thought of its national interest, erroneously centered around defeating Russia. Neither the people of Sri Lanka, Somalia, Lebanon, nor frankly Ukraine were relevant factors in the West's decision. Borrell, whose job as a diplomat suggests that he should be investing in diplomacy to resolve conflicts, has repeatedly called for widening the scope of war on Russia, insisting that the war can only be won on the battlefield. Such statements were made with Western interest in mind, despite the obvious devastating consequences that Borrell's battlefield would have on the rest of the world. Still, Borrell had the audacity to chastise G20 members for behaving in ways that seemed, to him, focused solely on their national interest. The hard truth is that national interests often outweigh general commitments to bigger ideals, he wrote. if defeating Russia is central to Borrell's and the EU's bigger ideals, why should the rest of the world, especially in the global south, embrace the West's self-serving priorities? Borrell also needs to be reminded that the West's global battle of narratives has been lost well before February 24th. Much of the global south rightly sees the West's interests at odds with its own. This seemingly cynical view is an outcome of decades. In fact, hundreds of years of real experiences, starting with colonialism and ending presently with the routine military and political interventions. Borrell speaks of bigger ideals as if the West is the only morally mature entity that is capable of thinking about rights and wrongs in a selfless, detached manner. In addition to there being no evidence to support Borrell's claim, such condensing language, itself an expression of cultural arrogance, makes it impossible for non-Western countries to accept or even engage with the West regarding the morality of its politics. Borrell, for example, accuses Russia of a deliberate attempt to use food as a weapon against the most vulnerable countries in the world, especially in Africa. Even if we accept this problematic premise as a morally driven position, how can Borrell justify the West sanctions that have effectively starved many people in vulnerable countries around the world? Perhaps Afghans are the most vulnerable people in the world today, thanks to the 20 years of a devastating US-NATO war, which has killed and maimed tens of thousands. Though the US and its Western allies were forced out of Afghanistan last August, billions of dollars of Afghan money are illegally frozen in Western bank accounts, pushing the whole country to the brink of starvation. Why can Borrell not apply his bigger ideals in this particular scenario, demanding immediate unfreezing of Afghan money? In truth, Borrell, the EU, NATO, and the West are not only losing the global battle of narratives, they have never won it in the first place. Winning or losing that battle never mattered to Western leaders in the past, because the global South was hardly considered when the West made its unilateral decisions regarding war, military interventions, or economic sanctions. The global South matters now, simply because the West is no longer determining all political outcomes, as was often the case. Russia, China, India, and others are now relevant because they can collectively balance out the skewed global order that has been dominated by Borrell and his likes for far too long.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him,
الجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we will be discussing about the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently focusing on the 16th sermon, where Imam Ali alayhi salam talks about the strategy that he has in place for reforming the Islamic Ummah. And the very important strategy that he had in mind was the filtration process that he had, that he was planning for. And that was where he said, where he says, لَتُغَرْبَلُنَّ غَرْبَلَةً, that you will be certainly filtered in a severe, in a severe filtration process. And we talked about the battles of Jamal and Siffin, and also the Battle of Nahrawan, whereby the third war was actually another filtration process, whereby those who were fooled by these apparent, show of modesty and apparent show of religious adherence of, by some people, those who were fooled by that were filtered out of that process, through that process. And it was as if Imam Ali alayhi salam was telling them, do not be fooled by the apparent beautiful recitation of the Quran by a few people. Rather, look at the reality of Islam within them. Look whether they are truly people who use their intellects, who use, who understand the inherent details of Islam, or are they people who just suffice to apparent, crusty, teachings of Islam without actually developing a true, you can say, connection with it. This was the filter that Imam Ali alayhi salam was talking about.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. Now that you, that Imam Ali Islam talks about this filtration process that will happen, he was trying to prepare the people that, look, I am inheriting a dirty water, of the dirty water of Muslims. Like, this Muslim community is made up of dirty things. I need to filter this out so that the beautiful water of Islam remains. This which I am inheriting is a wreckage because of what the previous leaders have done. But this filtration process will wake you up. So it was the people now, their turn to prove that, you know, we need to do the right thing. But unfortunately, a few of the people, they remained in their old ways and they decided not to change. And therefore, Imam Ali alayhi salam had to take very harsh measures. And that is when Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَلَتُسَاطُنَّ صَوْتَ الْقِدَرِ, O people, you will be mixed like how the contents in a boiling pot are mixed. So for example, if you look at a pot with boiling water, how the bubbles and how the water content is mixed severely, everything is like turned around and around. And this is what Imam Ali is saying, that you, the whole of the Muslim Ummah, will go through that. It should not be conceived wrongly here that Imam Ali is trying to say that those that are on top will be brought down and those that are down will be brought up. No, that's not what Imam Ali is saying. The criterion here is not that those who are downtrodden, just because they were downtrodden, will be brought up. No, the criterion is something more lofty. The criterion will be those people who are adhering to the true teachings of Islam, who are pious, will be the ones that will be brought up. Not that those who are down, whether they were bad or good, whether they are pious or not, will be brought up. Unfortunately, in some of the revolutions, we saw that people just, formed a revolution, and those who formed that revolution were the downtrodden people. But when they came to power, they didn't have proper criterion for keeping those who are for keeping those positions, and therefore they just brought people because they were downtrodden and they were below. This is not the way. Otherwise, the revolution might not go ahead and it will come across very many hurdles.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. So what Imam Ali alayhi salam was saying here, that you will be boiled severely, that you will be mixed completely, means that that order, that system that was brought about by the caliphs before me, I will change that system. I will recalibrate the whole Muslim Ummah. I will apply new criterion. I will apply new criteria for leadership. I will apply new criteria for who deserves anything from the Islamic, system. This will be a new calibration, and therefore the system will be very different. Therefore, be ready for that. And that was what Imam Ali alayhi salam wanted the people to realize. In other words, now the road was open for everyone. There was equal opportunity for people to progress, for people to show and express their potential. There were people at the time of the previous governments, before the coming of Imam Ali alayhi salam, who had the potential. They had the potential to grow spiritually, to grow materially, to have specific positions. But because the calibration in the previous governments was such that such people were not able to actually achieve those places, those positions, those spiritual and material progresses that were required. So this new calibration that was based on the teachings of Islam that was brought about by Imam Ali alayhi salam meant that now the Muslim world had that freedom. The people in the Muslim Ummah had that opportunity to flourish, to grow, to have that freedom, to progress. And this was what Imam Ali alayhi salam wanted from all of these harsh steps that he wanted to take. And this was something that only a brave and powerful and knowledgeable person like Imam Ali alayhi salam could do. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد مرجد والنور
والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As 2,500 West Bank residents face expulsion by the Zionist regime. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Shatan Hamad, journalist. This article is published under the heading The Palestinian Mothers of Masafer Yatta and the Fear of Displacement. Stay tuned for more. In the small kitchen of her home, threatened with demolition at any moment, Leila Mons was cooking rice and lamb stuffed zucchini in yogurt sauce, the smell of the traditional Palestinian dish filling the place. Meanwhile, her children gathered in the living area preparing to eat lunch. As Mons stirred the yogurt on the stove, all that was racing through her mind was the fate of her and her family, for the Israeli regime has started to implement its decision to demolish 12 Palestinian villages in Masafer Yatta, south of Al-Khalil, where some 2,500 residents live, in order to turn the area into a military training zone. The Israeli regime army had previously demolished part of her family home in the village of Jamba, but the expulsions faced by Masafer Yatta today are not aimed at demolishing one house here or there, but rather to uproot all the residents of the area. Women will be among the worst affected by the mass expulsions. Firstly, they are already a marginalized group lacking basic needs in the community, such as women-only clinics and training centers. Secondly, they bear responsibility for their families, a task that is increasingly difficult and complicated under the harsh conditions in Masafer Yatta, and especially in Jamba, where the Israeli regime occupation prevents the building of infrastructure or the paving of streets. As a result, residents are kept living in primitive conditions. Mons, 44, shared with Middle East Eye the details of her daily life as a mother and as a woman. She said, "As women, our life here is hard. We start our days very early by milking the sheep, then make bread on the fire. After that, we make breakfast for the children before they head to school, and during the day, there are many duties we have to carry out. Mons has 12 children, 4 of whom have finished or are completing their university studies. Yunus studied vet medicine, Halima speech and audiology, Batul studies education, Rayan studies Arabic. The main goal of educating our children is to reinforce our presence here and develop our village, Jamba. It's not easy, but we are working on achieving it, she said. These mothers' concerns over their children start from the very first moments of their life. Mons, who constantly worries about her children, gave birth to her first child, Yunus, while being transported by tractor. Yunus survived miraculously, and I experienced the same suffering with each birth due to the difficulty of reaching the hospital and the presence of Israeli barriers that obstruct our movement, she said. These days, an additional concern preoccupies Mons. Jamba school, like the village's housing, is threatened with demolition, a threat that hangs over all schools in Masafer Yatta, even though they were established with the support and funding of the European Union, Mons said. I'm worried about the fate of the children and their future. Where will they study if the schools are destroyed, and how will they achieve their dreams? This great fear of displacement hanging over the people of Masafer Yatta only intensifies the feelings of anxiety and tension for the women of Jamba. Mon said, I live with great anxiety. I feel that my throat is dry from the intensity of the fear we live in. We wait for the end of each day in order to feel that it has passed without us being displaced, and we prepare for a new day. All the women in Jamba feel this insecurity acutely. Two sisters, Fatima and Al-Jabarin, 58, and Halima Al-Jabarin, 52, talked to MEE as they prepared lunch for when their children returned from herding sheep. We mainly depend on grazing sheep. By the Israeli settlements and the army have come to surround us and prevent us from grazing freely, said Halima, adding, our children are constantly attacked by settlers and the army, which keeps us worried about them until they return. Fatima said that persecution by Israeli regime army extended into Jamba and into the homes of the residents. The settlers launch attacks on Jamba, and the army constantly breaks into our homes and conducts military exercises between them, which puts residents in danger all the time, Fatima told MEE. Even at night, the women of Jamba live in a state of anxiety due to danger from quite a different direction. One recent night, Halima and Fatima, who live in adjacent houses, saw a rattlesnake nearby, considered one of the most venomous snakes in Palestine. Fatima said, I used to hear it whenever it moved. I could not sleep for fear it might bite one of my children. I stayed up late and checked on them all the time. Halima said that after the birth of her daughter, her only child, she would rarely leave her, and that she was constantly worried about the snakes and scorpions. Halima said, one time I found a dead scorpion near my daughter, I panicked. What if it had stung her? She is my only child, and I am terrified of losing her. Fatima and Halima's preoccupations with their children's safety have led to them neglect their own health problems that have arisen as a result of their difficult living conditions. Both mothers suffer from breathing problems due to the dusty weather in Masafer Yatta, and Halima suffers from diabetes and high blood pressure. Halima said, women here may die before reaching the hospital. I sometimes suffer from high fluid levels in the lungs, and my life becomes in great danger. In June, Halima and Fatima lost their mother, Latifa Mahmoud al-Jabarin, who was 95 years old. She died at the public hospital in Yatah, and neither Halima nor Fatima were able to be with her in her last moments. With the pain of their loss still all too present, they nevertheless must confront the continuing fragility of their own and their family's existence. There is real threat of our homes being demolished and of our displacement from Jamba and Masafer Yatta forever, said Halima, adding, we will not accept that and we will never leave our homes even if they demolish them on top of our heads. Her mother was one of the most prominent members of Jamba. She was the only midwife who helped the women there give birth, rescued them when necessary, and saved their children. With her death, Jamba lost one of its most important women. Fatima cried as she talked about her late mother. We learned steadfastness from our mother, who was one of the most powerful women and on whom the village depended greatly. Today, it is not just us who lost a mother, it is the whole village. Since her death, the women of Jamba have had to move to the homes of their families and friends in Yatta when their due date approached, so that they can be near to a hospital to save their lives and the lives of their offspring. They return a few days later with their children.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very beautiful and noble hadith narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. And this hadith is about the rights of the prisoner. As you know, everybody, every human being in the religion of Islam has certain rights. You know, there's a very famous book called Risalatul Huquq, The Treatise on Rights, which has been narrated from Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. In that book, the Imam mentions the various rights of people upon one another, the rights of God, the rights of, you know, the Prophet, the rights of the Aimma alayhi salam, and also the rights of people upon one another. And there are no people except that they have certain rights, even the prisoner, even the criminal, right? In this hadith, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam alludes to one of the rights of the prisoner. Imam Sadiq said that it is the duty of the imam. By here, probably the imam is referring to the imam in the technical sense of the infallible imam. Rather, the leader of the Islamic government, or the leader of the city, or the leader of a certain area, it is the duty of the imam to release the prisoners on financial charges on Fridays and Eid, meaning religious festivals, to observe the congregational prayers. Meaning, obviously, in the era of the occultation of the 12th imam, when the Friday prayers and the Eid prayers and these kind of prayers are not obligatory, perhaps this is something which might not be incumbent upon the leader of the Islamic government. This is something that should be taken up and discussed in Islamic jurisprudence. Right now, we don't want to get into the details of this ruling, but we can say that at least, if not anything, in the era of the presence, the physical presence of the imam, this is something which is incumbent upon the leader of the Islamic government or the city. It's necessary for him to release these prisoners and allow them to take part in the Friday prayers and also the Eid prayers, and to observe their congregational prayers at this time. The imam then mentions something which might come to the mind of our listeners, and that is this: well, what if these people are really criminals and culprits? For example, they might be murderers, and they might, you know, want to commit more crimes if they're released at these times. The imam then provides a very practical solution to this. He says he may send them guarded, and when they complete the prayers and the feast, he should return them to the prison. A very practical solution to this problem. Right. So there are certain rights in this hadith. Obviously, the imam has alluded to certain religious rights. It's also interesting to note that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam mentions some other rights of the prisoner. The Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says the Prophet would imprison for 6 days he who has been accused of killing. The kin of the killed must come with evidence, and if not, he is freed. So it's not true that somebody can just be kept in jail indefinitely, right? If evidence is not produced, then the prisoner would be freed in the time period allotted, mentioned by the Imam Sadiq in reference to the Prophet. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the rights of the prisoner in the words of Imam Sadiq. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
This one lay.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.